Should conspiracy theories be debunked in school? How restricted is Webb's view of the sky? And how can we preserve history in the information age? All this and more in this week's Overtime Question Show. Uh-oh, Razor's in the forest again, and that means this is another one of our Overtime Question Shows. But the machine rolls on, the questions must be answered. So let's get into this week's Overtime Questions.
Louis Alexander Parent, should common space-related conspiracy theories be better or at all taught in school? I feel science teachers would have the proper fact-based influence with students to fight all the nonsense. So when my kids were young, we used to play a game called Snopes. And what we would do is I would go to an entry on Snopes, which is this really cool website that keeps track of myths and conspiracy theories and things like that. And I would read out the thing, right? And then the kids would have to figure out whether or not this was real or not, whether it was true or was fake. And they loved it. And it was great because then we would do some research, and when something was actually true, it was sort of like a really interesting conversation. And so I don't think that you can teach children or adults to specifically believe or be specifically aware that there are various conspiracies, because if something doesn't sort of pattern match the exact conspiracy that they have been trained for, then it will slip through and it will infect their brain. But the thing that you need to do, and this is what Carl Sagan was always a big fan of, was to build people's baloney detection kits, that you have to build a scientific mindset perspective on how you evaluate the kinds of truth claims that are being made at you, right? And so, you know, there are, when we sort of read through health news in the newspaper, when we think about when people are mentioning conspiracy theories on the internet, things like that, that you can approach this with a scientific mindset, a skeptical mindset when you think about these things. And many cases, a lot of that stuff just doesn't pass the sniff test. And so you could just ignore it immediately. And so, no, I think we don't teach specific conspiracy theories. We teach rational thought. We teach ways of evaluating statistics and evidence and like how people come to rational conclusions. That's the kind of thing that then can stick with them for life. And so now, you know, I will often talk to my son and he'll be like, oh, I heard this thing. And I was, you know, it's obviously total bullshit. And I'm like, yeah, good one, right? You're right. Because he just has that skeptical mindset. And I do think that kids these days are very familiar with the idea. Now, like, I'm sure a bunch of you right now are watching this. Like, I'm sure some of you are young right now, and you are very kind of just default skeptical about when something, you see something, you're like, it's probably AI. Oh, that probably didn't happen. Oh, that's probably disinformation. Oh, that's probably, you know, some ridiculous claim that's being made by somebody and it's not true. And that it's in fact older generations who grew up in this media world where Walter Cronkite was telling you that something was the way it was, and you just believed it because he was a pillar of journalists, of hardworking journalists that were out there attempting to determine whether or not things were true or not. And so there was this base level of trust and expertise and so on. And that was good because people could just agree that reality was reality, but it was bad because you delegated your skepticism, you delegated your truth seeking to other people. And now we're all having to evaluate things in real time. And so I think, I hope, like when someone goes, oh, look at this cool picture, you know, look at this sad picture, I'm like, before I even look at it, I'm like, it's probably AI, but I'll take a look. And then I'll be like, okay, this looks real. Like, they've got the right number of fingers. Now, how can I figure out what is a source that is related to this picture or news that I can trust? Like, is NASA telling me that they have discovered a signal coming from Proxima Centauri, or is it showing up in videos on YouTube? And I think the current generation, sadly, the young people today are, they live in a world where you kind of can't trust anything by default, and that you've got to figure out whether or not things are true or not before you take action. You don't want to get sucked in because somebody was, you know, fooled you. And so I think that this next generation, you know, the kids are all right. They are going to be very resilient and able to resist people's attempts to hack their brains, because they're on guard for this all the time. And that's like the downside, is that you have to be on guard for this all the time. You can't just live in a trusting society. You've got to be skeptical and suspicious of when people are sending you things and trying to tell you things. So that's my opinion. But you're, you know, the kids that are there, the people who are, say, under 20, tell me if that, does that match your perspective? Do you feel like you have to spend a lot of your time just not believing things that people are trying to show you? There you go. Sanctuary cryptid all the time. Dakshua agree. So you guys are going to be fine. You're not going to get fooled. And other people will, but they will learn the terrible hard lesson, and they will learn to become more skeptical over time. And, you know, like every time humanity faces a new technology, we are caught flat-footed, and there is enormous upheaval and change. And you think about when the printing press was introduced, it led to wars, religious wars. And we're not having religious wars. We are merely having people try to lie towards each other to try to distort reality. So, and we will build in, we will learn to live in a world where trust and truth is a rare commodity, and something that needs to be protected and preserved, and you seek it out. So that's like one of the things, you know, people are always say, oh, are you worried about AI taking your job? And, you know, I actually think that in a world of slop, AI slop that is coming for us, the tidal waves of AI slop that are making their way towards everyone, that people are going to go like, okay, fine. So where's a place that I can go that I can see space news reported by actual human journalists who are attempting to tell the truth? Oh, Universe Today, that's the place. So I actually think we'll do okay. Russell Breyer, how restricted is JWST field of view because of the sun shield? So yeah, so the sun, when you think about JWST, it has this tennis court sized sun shield, and the telescope is on the other side of the sun shield. And so the sun shield is blocking the view to the sun. And when JWST is observing, it can only see half of the sky, but it actually can see even less than that, because the telescope itself can only, and I forget the exact number, it's like it can only go down 45 degrees. If you sort of imagine, here's the sun shield, and the telescope can kind of go like this, and then it can kind of go like that, right? And so it can't look down, can't look straight up, it can only look sort of like at this angle. But that's for half of, and so that's half of the year. 6 months later, now the sun shield is in the completely opposite direction, and now the telescope is able to look at the other half of the sky. But even more so, the telescope is turned so that it's looking downstream of its orbital direction. So, you know, we learned that there are more micrometeorite impacts hitting it, and in some cases there are some larger ones than people are expecting. And so they've changed the way they observe with James Webb so that it is now, so if you imagine it's moving in orbit this way, it's going to turn back and look downstream. And so, you know, turn the sun shield on the side, and it can go sort of looking around as it's going around the sun. I know my hands don't make great sun shields and James Webb telescopes. And so like over the course of an entire year, they can have it look at any object that they want. They just can't look at all of the objects at the same time, depending on its orientation. So it's restricted at any one time. If they're like, quick, we have to look at this object and it's near the sun, James Webb cannot participate. Mikhail Billman, how do we preserve history? SSDs don't last forever. Quantum computing? This is a question like that haunts me, which is how do we protect history? So in the olden days, you know, the Sumerians would use clay tablets and they would store records about their existence. And then you had people writing on text in papyrus. And then you had the printed page in the book. And you had all of these historical artifacts that were a history of human society. But since the 2000s, we have put everything that we do onto the internet. And there is no record of what we do that isn't under electrons. And so if for some reason I decide that I don't want to run Universe Today anymore, and I don't want to, you know, nobody wants to step up and keep running the website, then its server bills will go unpaid and the website will go offline. And of course, we've seen that countless times that web pages go offline. And so 30,000 news stories about space, 25 years of space exploration would just no longer be accessible. Now, there would be mirrors, and there, you know, because of my Creative Commons 4.0 license, people would have been making plenty of copies of what we've done, but you're going to lose that direct connection to the history that we reported. And we saw with archive.org, it went offline. Like the Wayback Machine, the history of the internet that is being stored, like they are recording this history of the internet every couple of days on every single website that is relevant. They were offline for a little while. They're back in read-only mode right now while I'm talking about this. But there was, you know, people are trying to sue them, and they may sue them out of existence, that the very history of the internet might just disappear. And so it's entirely feasible, possible to believe that 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, we will have no history, right? We will have no written history, that every article that was ever written, every story that was done, every podcast that was recorded, every video that was recorded, that was stored on a server, on a, you know, somewhere, people stopped paying the server bills and the data was destroyed. The hard drive was overwritten. The material was gone. And we will be living in the moment, and that we will have no just permanent archive of what came before. Now there's a couple of sort of interesting projects. Like I know that in Europe, I think in England, I know Tom Scott did a video about this, that there's a giant, library where they print off websites and keep them in this giant archive. But yeah, we are like you or the world or in the future of humanity is depending on me to pay my server bills to maintain what is one of the most comprehensive archives of the history of space exploration in the early 21st century. Right? We have 30,000 articles on Universe Today. I pay $1,000 a month to maintain that server. And if at some point, $1,000 a month, or, you know, at some point I retire, nobody wants to take Universe Today off my hands, I can no longer pay the expenses, it'll just vanish. So it's a problem. It's a big problem. And it sort of occurred to me like 25 years ago. I actually wrote a letter and I printed off and I signed it with this exact concern. And I sent it to the government and said, I'm really concerned about what's going to happen. And nobody got back to me. Arjun, when we visit other planets, we find everyone's ancient civilizations. It's crazy to think like the distance between stars is so vast, especially when you think about the amount of time that it would take to actually travel from star system to star system, that even when we see a civilization, we think about like the history of humanity, a civilization that's 100 light years away from us is seeing us 100 years ago. They're, you know, we've just started to develop flying machines, the internal combustion engine. Like, what humanity looked like in 1924 is dramatically different than what it looks like in 2024. But that's nothing compared to the amount of time that it would take to actually cross the gulf between stars, to fly from one star system to another star system. That we could actually make the journey at the very fastest. If we go 20% the speed of light, 10% the speed of light, we're turning a 100 light years of distance into 1,000 years of travel. Like, we really can only go to the closest star systems, to Proxima Centauri, Barnard Star, you know, things that are just a few light years away from us to actually try. You know, 50, it could take us 50 years to get to Proxima Centauri. That you could be a grad student when you begin on your mission, and you're ready for retirement when your mission arrives at Proxima Centauri. And so wherever we go, wherever we see, whatever we want to explore, we are looking in the past. And I think that is the biggest problem that science fiction has filled our head with, right? Is that at Star Trek, Star Wars, everything's in real time. That you get in your spaceship and you're communicating with other people halfway across the galaxy, and you go to warp speed and you arrive at your destination, and it's just like hopping in a ship and going from one island to another island. But it's nothing like that. And yet now that has primed us. It's changed our expectations that, oh, space flight should be like that, and that anything less than a warp drive is unacceptable. And yet it might be that we can never move faster than the speed of light. You know, you think about the implications. If faster than light travel is possible, then we should see alien civilizations moving all over the place. They should be arriving all of the time. And so the fact that we don't see, it's like another paradox, right? The fact that we don't see warp drive aliens here means that either we are alone in the universe, and so we will be the first and only civilization to develop warp drives, or warp drives are impossible. Because if warp drives are possible, then you could have then the observable universe is no longer the limit. You could go 100 trillion light years to travel faster than the speed of light. And so not only do we not see evidence of aliens in the observable universe, we don't see evidence of aliens who have been flying in warp drives from beyond the observable universe. And so that just is more, so either we're alone or warp drives are impossible. But you can't have both. You can't be in a populated universe where warp drives are possible. Joe Jr. Why doesn't the scientific community ever refer to our moon and the sun by their proper names, Luna and Sol? Because they're not really the official proper names. They're just the word sun and moon in another language. So should we call Mars Aries? Is that the official name of Mars, is Aries? It's just, you're saying the same word, you're just saying it in a different language. So Terra, we call Earth Terra, which is a different language. Sure. Fine. So in Chinese, the moon is Yue. So why don't we just call it Yue, right? Which, those of you who've watched Avatar, The Last Airbender, that's going to blow your mind when you know that the name for the moon is Yue. So it's, that's not really the real name is moon translated into every language. Joshua, have they come up with a moon time zone yet? They're almost there. So, the European Space Agency and other agencies are meeting and have been working on the specific time zones for the moon. And there's like a couple of issues. Like, one is that the moon moves through the sky, and so it doesn't match any specific time zone on Earth. It changes as it moves. And then the other thing, and this is sort of really kind of sort of harder to catch, is that the mass of the moon is lower than the mass of the Earth. And so time moves differently when you are on the surface of the moon than when you were on the surface of the Earth. And that's not a big deal, but for atomic clocks and for global positioning systems, it absolutely matters. And so they need to figure out a way to deal with the drift of time between observers on the Earth and observers on the Moon. Sean Kosher, could the observable universe boundary be evidence for the alien zoo hypothesis? I mean, it would be a weird fluke that the aliens have decided to erect a sphere around the Earth that is 46.5 billion light years in radius, and that every year they expand this sphere by an equivalent amount of the expansion of the universe to make sure that no part of the edge of the outside of the observable universe is possible. But it doesn't matter because we can't see earlier than 13.8 billion light years ago, or 13.8 billion years ago. And so it would be very heliocentric for us to think that we are the center of the alien zoo hypothesis. Now, that said, of all of the possible explanations for the Fermi paradox, I personally find the alien zoo hypothesis the most plausible, or the second most plausible after we're alone. It's the one that would explain everything, you know, that we live in a simulation or we live in a galactic zoo. And that someone is attempting to manage our perception of what we see. If they're sufficiently advanced technology, they can decide what we can see from the surface of the Earth. They can surround the Earth in something that changes our perception of what's out there in the real universe. And only by breaking beyond the boundaries of this would we actually see what's truly out there. I don't believe it. I think we're alone in the universe, and that's why we don't see any aliens. But, you know, of all of the possible explanations, yeah, I think that's the one that answers all of the questions.
I hope you enjoyed this week's Overtime Question Show. A lot of fun questions. Now, this is the extra material, the things that we don't normally publicize, but when we've got a holiday or I'm on a trip or something like that, then we dig through the archive and we put them into video form. But if you want all of the additional questions, everything that I get asked during the 2 hour long question show, we release all of the additional audio over on our special patron-only podcast feed. So if you join our Patreon, you will get a link to our special patron-only podcast feed that will give you access to over 60 additional podcasts, patron-only question show, all the additional audio from our overtime questions, all available to you. You can listen whenever you want. So go to patreon.com/universetoday. I want to give thanks to somebody very special to Universe Today. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew M. Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Giltan, David Matz, Dennis Liberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, ScienceWorldRecord.org, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. So today, as I'm recording this, was the last day of writing from Nancy Atkinson, who is our senior editor at Universe Today. And Nancy has been with the publication almost since the beginning, writing thousands and thousands of stories for Universe Today, mentoring other people at Universe Today, and really leading a lot of the reporting and editing style in our organization. And I can't overstress how much of a just absolute legend Nancy Atkinson has been for this site. She has gone on to write multiple books, done a lot of reporting for other places, and yet she keeps coming back and working for Universe Today until today. And so she posted her last story today, which sort of follows a theme about the difficulty of getting large payloads down to the surface on Mars. So thank you, Nancy, for all of the writing, for all of the years. I know you say you're retired, but I know you're gonna get bored and you're gonna wanna come back and you're gonna wanna write some more. So we will just sort of put a pin in this and we'll see you soon. But still, thanks for all of your work over all of these decades, and I hope you enjoy a relaxing retirement. All right, we'll see you next time.